When you say deal with the boobs, what does that mean to you?
Means that if it's too roughly, it makes me look like a brick. Not a brick house, but like a brick.
You want something that is more structured around the bosom area, like that has seaming
either
there?
That has seaming and is more structured, but also doesn't have a lot of floof.
It's not puffy there.
Yeah.
Not smocked. You don't want a smocked
no.
neckline.
No. Hi, I'm Maya Grantz.
And I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love.
In this episode, we're going to ruin Woody Allen. We're going to talk about Woody Allen.
It's like, how did it take us so long? And partly, he's ruined himself.
Okay, this is going to be really exciting because not only are we talking about Woody Allen, which it's kind of weird that we haven't addressed on the show so far. We haven't talked about him and his work. But we also have a special guest.
Oh my God, a very special guest, Alison Silverman, who was the first lead writer and then executive producer of The Colbert Report. She wrote for Russian Doll. She wrote for The Incredible Kimmy Schmidt. She wrote for The Office. She was on the early Daily Show. Like, she is one of the great greats. And she's also a close personal friend. And so we got her to come on and talk about Woody Allen. I'm so excited.
Before we bring on Alison, real quick, how you doing, Maya? What's going on with you? I'm not going to ask how you're drinking because we'll wait until Alison gets here for that.
Right. I'm, just when I think everything is making me lose my mind, things seem to be okay. And just when I think everything is kind of rolling, somebody in my family is like, I cannot take one more single day. So I feel like we're cruising. We're doing the best we can.
Yeah.
One fucking day at a time.
That's how it is.
And you?
Pretty much the same. I mean, I don't have children. So yeah, it's probably not as stressful. Just like hanging in there. It feels like people keep saying there's a light at the end of the tunnel or you can see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I kind of feel that way. But it's also like there's still so much tunnel and it's not really clear how much there is.
Yeah.
So yeah, what can you do? It's getting warmer in New York, at least this week. It'll probably be shitty next week, but that means like we could go out to dinner and sit outside, which will be fucking amazing because it's been so long.
Oh my God.
Since we've been able to go to a restaurant.
So I've been having some shoulder stuff and I finally had to go to the doctor because it's been a couple of months. And just having to be, because I haven't gotten vaccinated yet, just having to be in a waiting room with people. I mean, everybody was wearing masks, but that feeling of like...
And you were 6 feet apart, right?
We were 6 feet apart. Everyone was wearing masks.
I mean,
they were
so
organized.
Don't you go to the grocery store stuff?
We have our box of imperfect produce delivered once a week.
Goodness,
we are so like...
You are really in quarantine.
Well, yeah, because we're saving any of our risk-taking so our children can have social lives so they don't lose their fucking minds.
Right.
So like, even in a grocery store, I double mask and I feel... But something about like, I feel like in a grocery store, I'm always moving. And like when you're in the doctor's office, you're just sitting there breathing other people's air. And it was actually quite stressful. I know. And all of the medical staff, they've all gone all the way through vaccination. And it's still, I feel like the adjustment back to normal life, like I don't think it's going to be like, we're vaccinated. Like, I think there's going to be like,
okay, it'll probably be more for you than for me because I definitely have been. Like going shopping and going to doctor's appointment. You go out when, you know, it's not like only when absolutely necessary. Like I go outside, I go on the subway.
Go on the subway?
You know, when I need to buy something for Michael's, they charge for shipping. So you got to go pick up in store. And let me tell you something. The people at Michael's, the people who shop there, bless them, but they don't really observe the distance between, you know, the social distancing in line for the checkout. They really don't. So, you know, you start to learn, like, it's okay. I got my mask and I just don't put my face near them. It'll be fine.
Well, I just want to, first of all, thank our amazing listeners, especially our patrons, our conversations on this and on our Discord channel, the Sauce Speakeasy, have been righteous. And I also want to thank listener Lizzie, who let us know in an email, and our email is saucepodcast@gmail.com. She said, the subject line was great nap dress. And she said, when you Google the complete phrase, you get this. And she sent me a link to a great nap dress. So thank you, Lizzie. I appreciate it.
Did you buy it?
No, it has long sleeves and I can't do long sleeves.
You need a short sleeve nap
dress. I'm a very, I am a very sleeveless kind of gal. I don't work on these guns to fucking wear sleeves, okay?
But you're napping in it. You're not showing off your guns to anyone. You're napping.
Well, I'm showing.
I get it. Like, no, it's fine. Just, it's what you're comfortable with.
It's what I'm comfortable with.
What you feel feminine.
Because you have to feel cute. That's part of the nap dress. You nap in it.
It's kind of like, not exactly cottagecore, but you want to feel that sort of Little House on the Prairie, puff sleeve.
Fantasy.
Fantasia. While also being comfortable enough that you could simply lie down and fall asleep in it. I actually wore this dress specifically for you because it is, in my opinion, a nap dress.
Let me see.
Well, I don't know if you'll be able to see it completely, I'll stand up for you. So
very nice. Mm-hmm.
It's a little... Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's long-sleeved, which I know you wouldn't care for, with the little split neck, with these little boho.
I love the split neck.
The boho ties that
have love the boho tassels.
Little tassels at the end. And it's got this sort of like pleating in the front. It's sort of a swing dress.
Yes.
You know? So it's loose-fitting and yet flattering and totally comfortable. I bought this like 5 years ago from Old Navy.
For $3.
Exactly. So there's your fucking nap dress, okay?
All right. Well, guys, I know you don't really want us to talk about nap dresses. You want us to fucking ruin Woody Allen. So let's just get to it. So I'm so excited to welcome comedy writing legend and very dear friend, Alison Silverman, to come and be the third Jewess to talk about Woody Allen.
Welcome, Alison.
Hello, hello, thank you. You know, I am reminded in you saying that of, I worked in The Daily Show like ages and ages ago, 20 years ago, and then I left. And like 2 years later, I got a phone call that they wanted me to do a bit because they needed a Jewess to hold a baby that for a sketch, although that was going to be, it was going to be a bris. And it was like New York City. And I had been gone for 2 years. And they thought that woman will read that Jewish on TV.
Wow. I don't know whether to be disappointed. It's like, did they have so few Jewesses left on staff that they had to like,
Or just Allison just exudes a certain quality that they couldn't replicate with any other Jewess.
Right. I know a lot of friends who are Irish American will say they have the map of Ireland on their face. You know, their face is a map of Ireland. It's definitely like a map of Brooklyn or a map of, it's not a map of Israel. It's a map of Minsk or something.
But that's one thing I also find weird. Like one of my best friends, Liz, also has a very shtetl face. And yet it's a very different face from my own. And people used to think we were sisters. I was able to use her ID when she turned 21 and I was still under 21. And I was like, okay, guys,
like,
we look nothing alike. We look nothing alike, but that's sort of... Not to the goyim.
All right, what's everybody drinking tonight before we get into our really exciting and fun topic?
Allison?
I am drinking... It was a very surprisingly beautiful day here in New York, one of the first really lovely days, and I'm sure it'll be shit again in the next couple of days. Sorry, explicit language. So I have
The horse has left the barn.
We embrace that
Okay. I've got a Campari spritz. Campari nice. And some Prosecco and some soda and a little lime. It's very refreshing nice. And lovely.
Very good choice. Maya, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking a rum and tonic, which is actually delightful. Rum and tonic with lime. Haven't done it in a while, but that's what was quick. Yeah. Very quick to put it together.
That's kind of funny because I'm drinking a gin and soda. My rationale here is I'm at the point as the weather's getting nicer, I've decided I have to lose my COVID-19, if you will. I got to start like cutting back on some of the empty calories. So I was like, I got to drink just like white liquor and a no calorie mixer. Ultimately, I landed on gin and soda because I don't like gin enough to drink it too fast.
Very smart. So we're all very fizzy for this episode, it's not our usual thing at all. That's right. Well, so we're here to talk about a comedy legend, about a cinema legend who also, in all likelihood, abused his 7-year-old daughter. So we need a little sparkle to get us through this, I guess. So obviously we're talking about Woody Allen. And what's bringing this up? And it's amazing to me, Rebecca, that you and I have never talked about Woody Allen, because on this show, we get drunk and ruin things people love. It would seem like Woody Allen is a cert. Like it should have been the first year. And we're only getting to it now. And it's brought up, of course, by the Allen versus Farrow documentary, 4-part documentary series that's on HBO right now. And so we thought we'd finally get to it. We're so happy you're with us, Allison. And I think we just wanted to start with, like, what was his influence on us growing up as these Jewish funny girls?
Well, I grew up in North Florida in Gainesville. So it's a university town. So my mom grew up in Brooklyn. My dad grew up in the Midwest. But I was definitely there were maybe 2 out of 450 kids in my high school class who were Jewish. It was not a Jewish place, at all. And I did not watch a lot of, stuff that felt particularly, I mean, I guess there wasn't a lot out there, but at any rate, what I remember really is that my parents would go out to see Woody Allen movies, and that was an event for them for sure. And in that sense, it felt different when they came back from a Woody Allen movie than coming back from another movie. For one thing, I think they were the only comedies that my mom kind of willingly went to. And also, though, they would come back and then my mom would have hated it. She always was like, it wasn't funny. It wasn't funny. But yet they would keep going. And then I think the first that I saw were probably Bananas or Sleeper. Sleeper remains like really up there for me. And I think most of my Woody Allen influences is the way that he influenced my sense of humor or something was along the lines of the more absurd stuff, you know. And I also, you know, was the kid watching Holy Grail over and over. A lot of it was that. And then it became, you know, I got as far as like Annie Hall and which I adore, and Zelig. I know we'll talk more about this stuff. But for me, I think it was the real comic things, comic pieces that I dug.
All right. Maya?
I loved, I mean, I have very early memories of Sleeper, actually. Yeah. And then I also, because we were growing up as these Jewish girls in like San Diego, which was not such a sophisticated place in the 80s and 90s. And I also read his books. He had those collections of short stories like Without Feathers. And those were so... They were so silly. They were so hilariously silly. And I feel like it was also this vision of like what world I could step into.
I feel like with Annie Hall or Hannah and her sisters, like these heroines who are like smart, talented women, and he's this kind of nerdy guy and they live in this glamorous New York. Like, I think there's like, oh, this is where I'm going to go when I grow up. In this right. world of like that was not, you know, San Diego military town with like surfer Nazis in the, you know, like it was
come
this
on,
place.
The surfers and the Nazis were usually different groups.
They were usually different, but it's like this is a place where I will fit in. It's sophisticated and intellectual. I want to be there.
Absolutely. I mean the idea that, well, this reminds me of something that I've heard said a lot. I think I first heard it when I was working for Conan, was like stupid comedy for smart people. Mm-hmm. And not that, you know, Hannah and her sisters or anything is like that, but certainly the books and stuff have this really, really, I don't know, I just love it. Like this feeling of like, I know the edifice. I'm both like completely familiar with all this stuff, and now I'm, you know, gonna just make fun of it for, you know, an hour or something. And
I
really
actually
joyous.
Looked at the books yesterday for the first time in forever. Like, I found a PDF online and I was looking at it, and I realized a lot of it is just an absurdist reading of very lowbrow culture. Like, there's this story, The Whore of Mensa, which is right. like, it's just a gumshoe story, but the trick in it is that instead of sex, these women are offering intellectual conversation. But formally, he's using all the formal sort of structures of a detective story. It's like the person comes in, I'm in trouble with my wife, the gumshoe goes. Like, it's, and so much of his stuff is just like, I'm reading the stupid world through my weirdo lens. But it's, yeah, it's still reading the stupid. I think that's why it like actually appeals to kids in a lot of ways. Like a lot of the, like when you're young, like he's not beyond what you can access.
It's funny that you guys are framing it like that. My experience of like becoming familiar with Woody Allen is almost the opposite of yours, Allison, in the sense that you loved his earlier, more absurd and silly films. I wasn't familiar with any of that stuff. I'm not even sure how aware, I was aware that he existed, but I don't think I gave much thought to him until, I think it was Hannah and Her Sisters was the first one I distinctly remember seeing in the theater. And for me, what I loved about it was, I was like, this is a grown-ups movie. This is a movie for grown-ups. It's like smart characters being smart and sophisticated and fancy, but also they're weaving these webs of lies and lying to themselves. And for me, that was what Woody Allen was. And that was followed not too long after by Crimes and Misdemeanors a few years later. And actually, Radio Days... In between those two, I saw Radio Days, and that was around the time when I saw Brighton Beach Memoirs, the film version of Brighton Beach Memoirs. So those kind of fit together for me in this like 1940s Jewish Brooklyn kind of setting where the dialogue was all really smart and funny and clever. And it just, the people, the characters weren't necessarily sophisticated in those, but I could tell that the movies were in a way that I found really gratifying.
And actually, I wanted to add, so I was talking to my friend Jeff Jackson, and I wanted to throw in something that he said. So in terms of the same way that Woody is this conduit, he's like this reader of like lowbrow culture, but through this lens. He was telling me how like for him in the 80s, growing up, you know, wherever and like in these weird places that he grew up, there wasn't a lot of access to European cinema yet or to like sort of all of the to art house film for him. But a Woody Allen film came out every year. And he told me about how when he saw Stardust Memories, he was like, oh, my God, this is brilliant. It blew his mind. And it was only years later that he saw 8 1/2 and was like, oh, he was just copying 8 1/2. So Woody Allen was often a conduit through which different kinds of cinema also were made accessible to Americans who weren't otherwise getting access to that, because he was going to do his Bergman. He was going to do his Fellini. He's a lover of film. And so all of his films are takes on those other
makers.
Right, absolutely. And I definitely see the Whore of Mensa and Play It Again, Sam, and stuff. There are, or Take the Money and Run, a lot of like the lowbrow stuff, but there's also like in Annie Hall, he goes to see the sorrow and the pity, like over and over.
Yes.
The running gag is that he's going to see the sorrow and the pity, and watching, you know, European films. And also that for me, I think when I think of seeing Annie Hall, that was pretty revelatory for me. And there's this part at the beginning, well, it's not at the beginning actually, but I don't know, first third. It's Woody as a little boy, Alvy Singer, and he's like seeing his doctor. His mom's brought him to the doctor because he basically won't do anything. And the reason he won't do anything is because the universe is expanding, and if it's expanding, eventually everything will break apart and there'll be. So that's sort
what
of,
is what is that your business?
Right. Brooklyn is not expanding. But like that sort of darkness that I think to me, who was a kid who dealt with a lot of like, I had a fair amount of OCD and a lot of fears and the existentialism, the darkness that he sort of would allow his character to inhabit and to sort of at his core sort of feel like, you know, this all ends with terrible deaths for all of us, was not something that I was seeing in other places and I really related to.
Yeah, and there's a certain kind of cynicism when he's tackling whatever observations, whatever he's observing and sort of laying into society and culture and people. There's a cynicism there that's
well, and it's
appealing.
It's a very Jewish cynicism. Mm-hmm. It's very like sleep faster, we need the pillows. Like, mm-hmm. So actually this is a perfect way to get into that thing about his persona, his sort of clown as a stand-up and as a comedian, the kind of Woody Allen-ness of Woody Allen, is that kind of combination of profound darkness, and yet it's so goddamn funny. It's like mm-hmm. that's the right, he's just right on that. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, if my big introduction to him was Hannah and Her Sisters, that's a film where he sort of plays the extreme version of that specific character. And if I recall correctly, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but his whole subplot in that is that he's trying to kill himself or wants to kill himself, right? And he's trying to find meaning in life, trying to decide if he should kill himself. It's very dark, but it's so fucking funny.
And what does he get saved by? He gets saved by the Marx Brothers. Like, he goes into the movie theater and sees the Marx Brothers, and that's what convinces him
Sullivan's Travels, yeah.
That's what convinces him life is worth living. So it might be good to just pause for a moment and say, like, he started in comedy as a comedy writer for Sid Caesar. He was in the writer's room. Can you imagine being in this writer's room with Mel Brooks, Carl Reiner, and Neil Simon? These are the people who he was like writing specials with.
Just to say, I think Selma Diamond, was she in Sid Caesar's room? I just want to shout out to the woman writer in that room, which I believe was Selma Diamond, who was on Night Court then, you know, in the mid-80s. Yeah, I want to make sure that's right. I know she was in a lot of those rooms, but I'm not entirely sure.
Yes, she was. She was one of the writers for Caesar and Coca's Your Show of Shows.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah.
So he is in the writer's room with Sid Caesar. And then at the same time, he's becoming a stand-up in the same kind of downtown village scene as Lenny Bruce, Nichols and May, Joan Rivers. Somebody once said, he's just ripping off Elaine May. He's just doing whatever May is doing. And it's a moment that we've spoken about before regarding Philip Roth, that it's this weird moment where Jews became white, where in the 60s, Jews who grew up in the 30s and 40s still very much as an other had that otherness, but they were also like becoming the stars and center and becoming very powerful. But they still had that feeling of otherness. And I think similarly to Philip Roth, there is that. He inhabits peak Jewish male in that era where he's like inside, but he can always feel like an outsider.
Yeah, and I think specifically Jewish comedy gained popularity in that time because of that, in a way that now just doesn't apply in the same way because of that outsider perspective.
You know, it's interesting because those many of those other people, I mean, Mike Nichols especially, like, is he's not exactly screaming his Jewishness, right? Like, he's like,
no, that's fair.
With pals Nichols, with yeah. Richard Avedon. I'm reading the Mike Nichols. There's a biography by Mark Harris, Mike Nichols, A Life, that I am reading, and I brought over right here because there were a couple of things in it that I thought might apply. But like, he and Lorne Michaels is also of the stripe. They are not broadcasting their Jewishness in any way. They're much more interested in appearing to be WASP and owning blueberry farms and Arabian horses. Yeah. And in fact, so in reading this, I just want to, there's this part that I just wanted to bring up at some point. This is the 1980s, and I'm sorry to digress into Mike Nichols for a minute, but
no,
he's directing.
No, this is perfect. By all means. This is
cool.
Great.
He's directing Hurley Burley by David Rabe. He's trying to find comedy, and it's a really pretty dark, misogynistic play. And it was a really tough rehearsal process, and Cynthia Nixon, who was in it, has this sort of memory of it. That so it's her words, but so he's talking about like the people who were there. William Hurt was in revolt, a couple other people. She says, to them, anything that made it less palatable was a virtue. So they didn't want the, you know, the anything comic in there. What was at stake from their perspective was the soul and integrity of the play, and by extension, the American theater. And this is like 1984. And here was this annoying showbiz guy, this Jewish comedian, trying to yuck it up and make it commercial.
Wow.
So I feel like they were a little afraid to let their Jewish flag fly. And I get a sense that, it, you know, that wasn't bullshit. Like, there's some reasons.
Even in 84. Wow. Yeah. So I feel like Woody Allen never bought a blueberry farm, and he couldn't wash away his Jewishness, right? And he leaned into it very much in the way that, like, Lenny Bruce leaned into it. He was, like, going to go all the way there with it. But he also became this multimillionaire Upper East Side. Like he had all of the he enjoyed all of the trappings of that. But then he still played in this realm where, even as he's becoming this king, he's always playing that he's just this, you know, clown.
I mean, you don't marry Mia Farrow if you're not something of a self-hating Jew.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I mean, that's his aspiration to waspiness right there.
Absolutely.
He broadcasts in every way sort of his self-hatred, but he has some joy about it, right? He brings comedy to the self-hatred.
Yes.
And I don't know if you've ever read the Orson Welles quote about Woody Allen. I think this is the moment for it, where Orson Welles said, "I hate Woody Allen physically. I dislike that kind of man. I can hardly bear to talk to him. He has the Chaplin disease. That particular combination of arrogance and timidity sets my teeth on edge." And the interviewer says, "He's not arrogant. He's shy." And Orson Welles says, "He is arrogant. Like all people with timid personalities, his arrogance is unlimited. Anybody who speaks quietly and shrivels up in company is unbelievably arrogant. He acts shy, but he's not. He's scared. He hates himself and he loves himself. A very tense situation. To me, it's the most embarrassing thing in the world, a man who presents himself at his worst to get laughs in order to free himself from his hang-ups. Everything he does on screen is therapeutic."
So wow. I think that's a great spot for us to wrap up this segment, because I want to circle back to that quotation and talk about that in our next segment, where we're going to talk about some of the bigger issues engendered looking at Woody Allen's work in light of what we know about
his personal.
Yeah, his personal life. Here is a gin that I purchased 100% because I liked the bottle. It has like a, what is that? Like a rabbit with antlers?
Yeah. No, that's very.
I don't know what that means. It has some what appears to be Chinese writing, and it's gunpowder, like gunpowder tea, but it's Irish gin. It's just very eclectic.
This is very good rum, by the way. I have to say, the Scarlet. I was like, what somebody brought it, the Scarlet Ibis. As somebody brought it as a gift. It's quite smooth.
All right.
Where
was I? Okay, so we all had our experiences growing up and enjoying Woody Allen's work. And we all were influenced or impacted in some way by it. We've talked about how he introduced us to certain aspects of cinema. He introduced us to a kind of Jewish humor, kind of sophisticated humor, dark humor that we otherwise weren't really exposed to. But I think we can all agree that at some point between then and now, our feelings about Woody Allen changed a little. I mean, the first big event was, of course, when his relationship with Sunyi Previn became public in 1992. And for those unfamiliar, Sunyi Previn was his wife's daughter, his wife's underage daughter, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, by the time they made it public, she was overage, but I think
when he was taking the naked photos of her, was she overage?
Perhaps, but also it seems like it was underage when during high school she'd come over to his place for lunch breaks and then the maid would like clean up the condoms.
Okay, well, that was more detail than I was aware of. Thank you. Anyway, our perspectives and feelings changed. My only question about that is, at what point were you sure, at what point did you know that you couldn't enjoy his films and him as a persona in the same way anymore?
In as uncomplicated as a way? You know, I remember seeing Deconstructing Harry, which was one of sort of his first big movies after the scandal. And in that movie, it's basically, I would say Deconstructing Harry is every Woody Allen movie, plus he is as disgusting as he really is. And I feel like there was something about that that was extraordinarily satisfying. I actually think it's one of his better post-Mia movies. It's a great movie, but it's also like, oh, this really is who he is. This sort of pill-popping, disgusting fucking human being. Like, there was something so honest about it. And I feel like as much as I enjoyed that movie, and I think I enjoyed it for its rawness, where you're like, oh, this sort of sweet nebbish, that's been your act the whole time. And I think that really, like, after that was very different for me. And I stopped watching his movies, not because I was like, I shall no longer see his movies, but I was like, I see who you are.
Interesting.
That is interesting. I have not seen Deconstructing Harry. I remember the posters well. And when you talk about him sort of exposing himself, as I was sort of saying that I used to love Zelig, which is like a documentary about like a 1920s figure who...
Chameleon.
Is a chameleon, yes. And you put him with, you know, some gangsters and he becomes a gangster. He starts talking like a gangster. You put him with, you know, whoever. Yeah. He just immediately physically, his body changes. The way he speaks changes. He just blends into whatever is there for him. And so I haven't seen it in many years, but certainly at the time it made me feel like it was about the dangers of not being authentic to yourself. That's what it felt like at the time. And that's what it felt like Woody's persona somehow was. Like, oh, he's not good looking. He does things that are different than everyone else, but he's just, you know, he's got to be himself. And then, as you say, like, I mean, one of the things, the scales falling from your eyes is like, oh, no, this is the cleaned up version of a really terrible man.
Yeah. It's funny, Maya, because you said that Deconstructing Harry is one of the first films that came out after all of that broke. But in fact, there were several films before that because the news came out in 92 and the movie Husbands and Wives came out that same year. And boy, that movie is a lot. And I remember seeing that in the movie theater and really grappling with the way that he was clearly, like, he had made a film about a middle-aged man who has a fascination with a younger, much younger woman, really girl, and there's some adulterous inclinations involved, and it's a very heavy movie. And then from there, he made Bullets Over Broadway, Mighty Aphrodite, Everyone Says I Love You. Like three light and fluffy, fun comedies. And then Deconstructing Harry.
And it's interesting because I didn't see any of the – I saw Husbands and Wives, but I didn't see the Happy, Happy movies.
Yeah.
But I saw Deconstructing – like I made sure
Me
to
too.
See Deconstructing Harry in the
I
theater.
I think it was the same thing because I was like, I don't want – I'm done with his bullshit. But then when Deconstructing Harry came out, I couldn't resist seeing that because it's like, oh, supposedly it's really confessional and he's just laying it all out there in terms of what a complete asshole he is.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that you brought up when we were – sort of planning this, is that one of the things that keeps coming up with Woody Allen defenders and with the whole conversation about it, and it's not just with him, it's with Michael Jackson, the art versus the artist. The art versus the artist. Like, yes. Oh, just because the artist is a pig, are you not going to enjoy the art? But he is in all of the, like, it's all about yeah. him. Like, it's not like he's making documentaries about somebody else. Like, it's like they're all self-portraits. What are you going to do?
In one way or another. Most of the time, he's actually literally in his movies. I don't know if it's most of the time. But in many of them, he's actually performing in them. But even when he's not, there are characters who are standing in for him, clearly. And even when that's not the case, it's still his fingerprints are on it. The Woody Allen-ness is still there. So you can't talk about separating the art from the artist in this case. I think if you were to do so, you would be missing a major component of the art, right?
Well, absolutely. Am I wrong? But I, to complicate matters a little bit, perhaps.
We like that.
Yeah,
here.
I mean, it's a sick point of view. There's no doubt about it. But there are also much, much, much more destructive sick point of views out there in the movies all the time.
That's actually true.
So I don't like the idea of having my daughter watch Hannah and Her Sisters versus having my daughter watch so many hundreds of other movies. It's like a very, you know, I feel like better to watch Hannah and Her Sisters and have the conversation about like, yeah, this, you need to know this about this movie and this artist.
Mm. Right. Right.
Yeah. That's a very good point. And I mean, he has such a huge body of work and so many really high quality films that you can't write them all off on account of his being a sexual abuser, like as films. But Maya, what?
Here's the thing. I can hold these two things in my mind at once. I can. Right. I am super capable of being like, this guy's a pig. And also, this movie is genius. And also, even as, for instance, Manhattan is genius, he is totally telling on himself. Like, yes. He's clearly obsessed with inappropriately young women for reasons that are super fucked up. And, like, I can hold all of that in my mind. You know who doesn't seem to be able to hold that in their mind, those contradictory things, are his fucking fans. Like, that's something that I'm finding really almost harder than the existence of him. I find his defenders rather difficult. I posted Maureen Orth is this journalist who's written for Vanity Fair about Woody Allen and Michael Jackson, and she wrote articles that were like 10 undeniable facts about the Woody Allen case, 10 undeniable facts about the Michael Jackson case. They're great articles. And I just reposted it on Twitter and was like, hey, this is kind of interesting. Moses Farrow, who's one of Mia's adopted sons, who's now on Woody's side, like, I'm sure there are a lot of journalists who would love to interview him, and it's interesting that he won't submit himself to the very rigorous fact-checking process. Like, you know, I thought it was a very mild tweet. The Woody Allen and Michael Jackson people came after me. They're sitting there on Twitter waiting for somebody to, like Maureen Orth. And, like, it's one of my friends, Gabe, was talking about writing a sort of vaguely ambivalent tweet about Woody Allen, and they came after him for thought crimes against Woody Allen. There's something really interesting about people's inability to acknowledge that he did some fucked up shit.
So in the context of the conversation about art versus artist, you know, can you separate the two? I think that's really interesting because what you seem to be saying is, in your experience, Woody Allen fans cannot separate the art from the artist.
No.
And in order to preserve their affection for the art, they have to be in complete denial that there's any problem with the artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Correct. They have to make Mia it has to be that Mia's just a demon monster psycho.
Right. Brainwasher.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. A brilliant brainwasher of a 7-year-old child. I mean, given how consistent Dylan was with her story,
and Mia continues did amazing to be. Work.
Yeah.
Into adulthood. Like, she didn't become an adult and look back and say, you know, I was manipulated. No, she's sticking to it. So, wow, good job, Mia.
So I think that's a question that's interesting to me. What is it about the fans who have such a hard time holding those two things together?
What do they why are they so invested? What do they have at stake that makes them unable to let go?
Yeah.
We're all just wondering.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking about it. I know when watching this is not an answer, but it is something that just comes to mind. In watching Alan versus Pharaoh, the thing that I was really taken, I don't know, my eyes were opened to Suni's plight. And I just started feeling so miserable and horrible for Suni.
Yeah.
So sad for her. And, you know, Dylan, what a horrific, unforgivable thing to have happen. She has really come out swinging and is a very strong person. I don't know that, you know, obviously that's not what we're seeing with Suni. And I just, I don't know. I was just thinking of her as an imprisoned person. And it,
Well, there's also something really weird in the documentary about how, like, when Mia talks about Woody Allen and, like, I didn't want him to be mad at me. I didn't want him to scream at me. I didn't want him to, like, when she's on the phone with him, like, there's something, and that he's Mr. Nebbish, but when he's on the phone with her and he doesn't know he's being recorded, it's
this is what I want to get to.
Oh, shit.
This is what I want to get to, which is when we know these things, it does change how we read and enjoy the movies. Putting aside any question of, like, ethics, is it right or wrong to enjoy the work of a horrible person or a person who's done monstrous things?
Right.
Assuming that by watching a movie, you're not benefiting this person or, you know, enabling them to continue to do horrible things. But putting aside those questions, there's also the impact that it has on the work. The work doesn't exist in part because what we just talked about with him being so in his own work, right? Your read of it, your appreciation of it, your understanding of what he's saying, where he's coming from changes. Like Maya, you were just talking about the nebbishy, shy character who gets on the phone and makes these fucking threats and is like laser focused, you know, he's not stumbling or confused or saying something embarrassing. No, he knows what the fuck he's telling her is going to happen. And we know that he did it. He followed through on those threats. So then when you're watching his films, you are forced to reconcile this persona that he's presenting in this self-deprecating, oh, I'm putting all my flaws out there on a platter for everyone to just see. But then he's not. The honesty implied in that, that like, I'm laying it all out what an asshole I am. I'm laying it all out what an idiot I am. It all falls into question.
Well, I've been thinking,
he's not an honest person.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that with Louis C.K. Because Louis C.K.'s whole thing is like, I'm just going to tell you all of my, I'm going to put it out there with all of my shit. With all of my, like, and that's why people love him. Like, oh, being a dad sucks and all this kind of stuff. And then you realize, like, oh, that's, like, such a useful front for you. Wow. But it's also a very real clown, too. Like, it's a very, like, the clown is always that alternate character.
Right, and that's a piece of art or craft. It's a work in itself.
I have a question about watching the movies, and I wonder if would your experience of watching a Woody Allen movie change if he were dead? If he was dead? My grammar might be off. Once he's dead,
if he were,
will it change your experience of watching his movies?
This is a very good question. Did you have more you wanted to say about it?
Well, no, I mean, what I would say about it is I feel like to me, he is dead. I don't mean that like, I haven't really enjoyed his work in many years. I don't see him as a vibrant part of the comedy community in any way. I don't mean that he's crossed a line and he's dead to me, because obviously I don't have, you know, that sort of personal relationship with him. I just mean he's kind of not a living thing. And I feel like, you know, especially with the things that, you know, Dylan and Ronan, and it just seems like, despite the defenders, it's the die is cast. So right. I kind
it
of
sounds
just,
like you're saying he's irrelevant, which is as good as being.
That, yeah, I do think I'm saying that. But I mean, I'm well said. I think that to me, in deciding whether to watch his movies or trying to sort of figure out my experience of watching his movies, I am planning to frame it entirely in, does it help me? Like, I just want to decenter him. And I don't care if it hurts him or if it helps him because he's dead. I just think, can it give me something? Is this something that will benefit me or take something away from me?
I love that.
I want him out of it. And also people like his editor, Susan Morse, or Diane Wiest, or, you know, the people.
Oh, Diane Wiest.
I don't want that. Oh. Yeah.
Well, and I actually have to read one of, so on our Discord channel, which is where our patrons go and we have conversations, and I said, hey, we're going to be talking about Woody Allen, and everybody had something to say, and a lot of this kind of stuff came up, and somebody said, I don't have a good answer. I watched many of his films before I really knew or understood his depravity in a way that makes me madder at him. Because he made me love interiors. And then because of the awful things he did and continues to do, he made me angry with myself for still liking interiors.
But Allison, I think that that's a really interesting framing of the whole question, the whole general question of separating art from artists. No one ever talks about it in terms of the consumer of the text. And what it does for them or can give them. It's always about the male genius.
Right.
You know, capital M, capital G, the male genius. And like, we've talked about this many times before.
A little bit.
It tends to come up. It just somehow, I don't know why, when you talk about culture and politics, it comes back again and again. That whenever you have accusations, particularly that have to do with gender discrimination and sexual abuse and those types of things, the questions always seem to surround, what are we going to do about this man and his work? Can we still enjoy it? Should we cancel him? Is it fair? Is he getting a fair trial? Like, it's all about him. Is the punishment that he is receiving appropriate to the crimes that he has committed? And it's rarely about the people who have suffered harm because of
right.
him and what it means to them if you do or do not enjoy his work or whatever, allow him to keep working. And it's pretty much never about the actual viewer, the consumer of the text, and what experience we're having as an audience. That doesn't seem to matter. It's framed as if it's just a flat-out choice. I choose to keep enjoying these works, boom, or I choose to reject these works, and there's no further digging into what that really means.
This is actually where I think things get tricky, and mm-hmm. I would even say dangerous, because I think that saying, like, look, ooh. There are things, I think that where I find it getting dangerous is this idea that in order to be as insightful as Woody Allen, in order to achieve a point of view that is as rare, that is as provocative, that is so outside the norm that it helps us see the norm, you have to be a sexual abuser. I feel like there's something in that where it's sort of like people who feel like, oh yeah, to be a rock star, you have to be a heroin addict.
Right,
you
right.
have to be like, and I think
no, it's
that's
the tortured artist thing. It's what, what's her name? Talked about in her comedy special.
Nanette.
Hannah Gadsby talked about with Van Gogh.
Picasso,
you have to be insane.
Van Gogh, right.
You have to be tortured to create real art.
And I think that that's where the sort of the way that his defenders are so like protective of him is I think they want to feel like that's the only way. Like the only way to make art is to be a fucking monster. Yeah. And I have permission. I have permission to be an asshole because that's where it comes from, is being an asshole. And it's, I think that that's part of what's hard about the, you know, artist, whatever. It's that this particular artist represents something for someone. And even his sins, if we're going to call them that, I think some people use them as an excuse or like, see, it's just, you gotta fuck your stepdaughter. I also have to say just briefly, something that really annoys me about his defenders is like, he wasn't even around, except he was a really good dad. And she was a really psycho, except she was a good enough mom that she really taught him the value of like family. And you're like, okay, you were shifting ground all the time.
But that's what they just protect him. But that's, yeah, that's cognitive dissonance in action. That's exactly how it works. They cannot hold the two dissonant thoughts in their mind. It's too painful. And
right,
they have to pick one side or the other. And the side they pick is, I cannot be asked to relinquish this thing. It is too tied to their identity, their sense of themselves, their sense of their own taste or values or something.
And yet deep down, I have to feel like the permission to be a monster is still a permission.
Oh, I agree. I agree. I think deep down, underneath every tweet that's giving you some fucked up fake evidence about how Mia brainwashed her daughter into whatever 30 years of consistent claims, underneath every tweet is no claim of sexual abuse is ever really true, or if it is, it doesn't matter. To me, it's like kind of implied there. They're just like, I'm not going to care about this.
Well, what are we left with, Allison?
Final thought?
Yeah, no. Well, I'm not sure that I do other than, when I was thinking about it, I definitely thought about it as in terms of being a viewer. And I also thought about it in terms of being someone who works in this industry and, you know, sees the fallacy of any kind of auteur claim, you know? And I thought about like some projects that I worked incredibly hard on and was credited, but certainly wasn't the main person on them. And what would happen if people just completely put that away because the person in charge did something really just not okay. Anyway, at any rate, it was it was hard to think about, like, I mean, I don't want to say shows I worked on because somehow I'm then putting them in the same breath as Woody Allen. I don't want to do that.
No. but it's a really good point.
And it's actually a really important perspective. So just to, if you could say a little more on that, like the sort of fallacy of auteur-ness, right, of the sort of performance or people who sort of say, in order to be the great comedian, I need to take on this persona. Like, if you could speak
to that. Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, I haven't worked in film, and I do know that it's very different. But in television, at least, and I think that it's sort of a contract between this person and the audience who likes the idea very much of one person who is behind all of this. And it's, you know, we also know all the fine artists who had like big teams who were actually producing the work. You know, it's just, it's always complicated. And often, you know, often there's someone credited who is, I mean, in TV rooms, very often someone who is credited who,
as the writer of the
episode. And authorship is very problematic in TV. So I just guess that part of me feels like, when I said like Diane Wiest or his editor, Susan Morse, like I do feel like I just feel for those people. As someone who works behind the scenes a lot, I don't want their legacy to, you know, be pushed aside because of this person that we decided was the most important all the time.
Very good point.
Yeah.
So it's a little more complicated than just can you separate the art from the artist? There's a lot more to it.
Because part of it is that we're so desirous to have this one guy, yeah, be everything. Like, we're always talking about Scorsese. We're never talking about Thelma Schoonmaker, who's, like, edited every fucking one of his movies for 40 years and is everything. And part of that is that that's part of the story that we need to have to keep funding going, to keep whatever going, is, like, here's the genius.
Yep.
And I'm sure that that's not good for the person who is the genius either. Like, I don't think that's good for anybody.
Probably not. No, but there's a tradition of art in Western culture that sees it as the product of one person's mind. So if film is to be an art, there has to be an artist. It can't just be a collaborative medium with writers, actors, director, producers, you know, cinematographers, grips, PAs, like, there are countless people involved. And that's just not, it just doesn't correspond with our notion of what is art. There has to be an individual from whose mind it sprung. But that's not really the case. Though sometimes his films do make it feel like that's the case.
Oh, yeah. He leans into that.
For sure.
But also, The Moose is great. It's great. It is some of the greatest. I'm sorry. It's just great. It's before he started, like, fucking children. It's great. Oh, my God. All right. Well, Allison, thank you so much. This was awesome. Thank you.
Oh, my. I really enjoyed it, guys.
Well, hey. Enough
because I was very, very nervous ahead of time. Like, what do you say about this guy? Oh,
come on. Come on. Well, the next time you want to come on and ruin something that people are loving, you have an open invitation.
We would love. Yeah.
You would love it. The next, please.
If you think of anything you'd like to tear apart, that we can join you.
We're right here.
Yeah,
right
here. We're here. We're here for it.
My first call.
Oh, that was so good.
That was great. It was so great to meet Allison. That was really my first time meeting her.
We just went right into it. It's the Jewess code.
I guess so. It's also that thing where people are vetted by other people. She's your friend, so obviously
we're gonna hit it off. But she was, and also to have like a legit comedy writer get to speak to those things was wonderful. So guys, if you like this and you like us, would you join our Patreon? Would you become a patron and join us on the Sauce Speakeasy and tell us what you think and the things you would like us to ruin?
You can find it at patreon.com/saucepodcast. If you join at any level, you can join the Sauce Speakeasy. And if you join at the $5 level, there's bonus material.
Yes.
Extra sauce. Sauce
extra
on the side.
Extra sauce. Sauce on the side. I think extra sauce is just fine. The sauce on the side, it just seems, it's like a little much.
I like it.
If you are not ready to join us, but you still love us, could you please...
That's good too.
Oh, we will take all your love. Please write a review of us on the iTunes or Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever we are coming into your brain head.
Exactly. And you can reach out to us directly. We are saucepodcast@gmail.com. We're on the social medias, the Instagram and the Twitter is @saucepodcast.
And if you want to talk to me and share more nap dresses with me, I am @MayaGarance anywhere you are looking for Maya Garances.
And she wants short sleeve nap dresses if you're
short sleeved or
something.
Really preferably sleeveless. How can people find you, Rebecca?
They can find me as @GynoStar on all the various platforms. We love hearing from you all. We love talking to you. You give us the best ideas for new episodes, or tell us what you'd like us to ruin next.
And until then,
adios, amoebas.